How many people here have heard of John Amos Comenius or Jan Amos Komensky before? I am so pleased that Joe has. He will have heard him for a particular special reason. Poor Jonathan's been subjected to my rants about him for about the past 4 years. Does anyone have no clue who this guy is whatsoever? There's no shame in that, by the way. This is wonderful, because that means that you'll believe what I say about him. What I'm going to do this evening is I'm going to give a bit of an outline of his background, of his life. I have assumed that people know nothing about him. And I've also assumed that we're only going to give a very basic historical sketch of the time he was living in. But I think we need to understand that in order to get some of where he's coming from. I particularly want to do a book plug right now, which is his one work that has been translated and majorly distributed into English from Czech, which is The Labyrinth of the World and the Paradise of My Heart. We're going to be reading some excerpts from it later. If you're lucky, occasionally Black Wales has this. Otherwise, you might have to go to the bigbadamazon.com. But do read it. It is phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And the other book we're going to be looking at is this lovely little tome called Orbis Pictus. This is arguably the first ever children's picture book published in 1658, written by Comenius himself. And we're going to look at some pictures from that, mostly because they're highly amusing. But I have this copy, so you can browse it at your leisure later if you like. We've got all kinds of useful things. It's a little bit like those children's picture dictionaries. So here's an artist's workshop with numbers and the words there, so you can find them out yourself. And you too can learn Middle Czech, sort of early modern German, and sort of some late medieval Latin in the process. So, why have I chosen this person? As John Comenius, he published a large amount of educational theory in Latin, and that is what he's largely become known as on the world stage, simply because, frankly, Latin is a much more effective international language than Middle Czech. As an educational theorist, he travelled widely, and he was invited to become the first president of Harvard University, which is where I suspect Joe knew him from.
No, I didn't.
He was invited to become the first president of Harvard University in the new British colony of America. He was invited to reform the public education system in England, but that project had to be abandoned because of the English Civil War. And then he was also travelled widely in Sweden, Hungary, and parts of Poland and Prussia, invited by their governments to advise on education. He is most famous for his widely circulated theories of education, and I would hesitate to say that every single one of us who grew up certainly in a European country and or who had an education based on a Western system of education was taught to some degree according to theories that he first argued for. So, he was, as I mentioned already, the pioneer of children's picture books. He was an early advocate of nature walks for small children as an educational method. So a lot of the things that we now associate with Montessori, he was arguing for much earlier. So he argued that children should be educated according to the world around them and they should be taken to explore the world around them as part of their education. He argued very, very strongly for vernacular education. He was the first person to publish widely and to write arguments that children had to be taught first and foremost in their mother tongue. And finally, his other contribution, which many of us will have benefited from, was mixed gender primary education. So he was quite the man. But he lived in a time of great upheaval in Central Europe. Although the religious upheavals against the Roman Catholic Church in the early modern era are generally popularly believed to be centred around the German-speaking parts of Europe, in particular with Martin Luther, they will come to Comenski's views on him later. He didn't think he was really a Christian. That's the spoiler there. The beginnings of the Reformation were actually well underway before 1517, 1518, if you count the publication of the 95 Theses as that. So 150 years earlier, there was this guy. Now, I have had numerous arguments with Czechs as to this man's nationality. Anyone want to guess where this man's from? Tip, many of you will have heard of him.
Oh, John Wycliffe.
It's John Wycliffe. Who was so influential in the Kingdom of Bohemia that they have a Czech version of his name. You will not believe how many fights I've had with Czechs over the nationality of John Wycliffe. Because Jan Wycliffe, you're Czech. Jan Wycliffe. Anyway, so about the same time as John Wycliffe was in Oxford and beginning to publish some of his slightly naughty ideas, there was a young man in Bohemia called Jan Hus, and he came into contact with a lot of Wycliffe's writings. And there is some argument that they might even have corresponded, though that might be lost in the mists of time. Jan Wycliffe, Jan Hus was already preaching and writing critically about the power of the Pope, the doctrine and practice of the sale of indulgences, and had translated the Bible into Czech. Now, Jan Hus was born in 1369, to give you an idea of, this would have been about maybe 1399 he started writing. And he eventually was burnt at the stake for religious crimes in 1415, so a full century before Luther. Now, unlike what had happened in England, where a lot of Wycliffe's theories had sort of gone underground and they were sort of still mouldering around a bit and they sort of re-emerged, what happened in the Kingdom of Bohemia was a full-fledged break from Rome, but about 100 years earlier than Luther. And so you see the Hussite church emerge. Now, the Hussite movement gained popularity and the death sentence of Jan Hus provoked riots and protests. And it culminated in something called the defenestration of Prague. Another thing you need to know about the Czechs is they love a good defenestration to start a revolution. It just happens an awful lot in their history. There's been 3 or 4 significant defenestrations, depending on how you count them, whether the person died or not, basically. One guy fell into a pile of horse manure, didn't die, so people argue, was that a defenestration or not? But they pushed him out a window, and they started that with the Burgomaster of Prague in 1419, and the 1419 to 1434, they had the Hussite Wars, which were basically the first Reformation wars to be fought in Europe. So that's like a full century beforehand, but they were happening in this tiny kingdom of Bohemia. Out of this Hussite movement, they grew a number of different, of what we might call Protestant, insofar as they're protesting against Rome. But I should add that the major, major points of dispute were the authority of the Pope, communion in both kinds, and the language of the Bible. So the Western Slavonic Reformation developed a very independent character to what you see from the later Germanic and Western European reformations. So, for example, Jan Amos Komenský, when we come to him in a second, will quote endlessly from the Apocrypha with no problem whatsoever, which was seen as sort of almost one of these, the first things to be binned were these dubiously canonical books in the middle. So there's some very distinctive Western Slavonic Reformation ideas. It has its own character that gets cross-pollinated as the other reformers rise in other parts of Europe. But they very much have their own personality, they have their own set of theologies, and they have their own culture. One of the most significant branches of this movement to emerge in the Kingdom of Bohemia was a group which was known as the Unitas Fratrum, or the Moravian and Bohemian Brethren Church. Now, for those of you who are familiar with the word brethren in the UK, it doesn't mean structured like the Brethren Church in England, okay? They just, the unit of brothers, they called themselves. This group was absolutely pacifist, and they sought a very humble lifestyle in which wealth was largely to be shared or given away. And initially, they opposed any involvement in politics whatsoever. They were severely persecuted as a group, and quite possibly because they were a bit of a soft target because of their pacifist beliefs. You could round them up and they wouldn't do anything, they wouldn't riot. By 1609, the uneasy peace, which had become a little more settled in the Kingdom of Bohemia, as Emperor Rudolf II, who was Holy Roman Empire, he issued a letter of majesty officially granting religious tolerance to all living in the Bohemian lands, whether Catholic or Protestant. I say Protestant is an interesting word to use here because it doesn't quite mean what it's come to mean, but I'm using it in its technical term from back then. But this was a short-lived peace. Now, that's 1609. Brief time, a brief sketch of the time in which Kamensky grew up. He was born the 28th of March, that's my birthday. When I discovered that, I loved him even more. In 1592, in a disputed location in Moravia, right in now the modern-day east of the Czech Republic, there's three towns which came to be his birthplace, all of which, I can tell you that Uherské Brod, Komná, Nivnice, and the all around, a little town called Uherské Hradiště. Can we all say Uherské Hradiště? No, okay, it's still a tiny, tiny, tiny little place now. It definitely was a tiny place then. His parents were devout members of the Moravian Brethren Church. And by that point, about 85% of ethnic Czechs were Protestant, to use that term. His family was poor and obscure. No one really knows that much about his parents. There's some indications from details in The Labyrinth of the World, which, as we'll talk about, has a lot of autobiography hidden in it, that they were possibly millers in that small village. There certainly seems to be an unusual amount of detail in that book about the workings of a mill for someone who otherwise had no need to know that sort of thing. In any case, he was raised by his aunt. He was orphaned at the age of 12, and his parents and two of his four sisters died of the plague that year. So at 12, he was orphaned. His education started late and appears to be patchy. This is a man who pioneered primary education. But the only dates we know for certain is eventually at the age of 16, he managed to get a place at the Latin school in a town called Přerov, which is actually quite a major city now. So it's highly unlikely he would have been able to get that place if he'd been completely illiterate. So he must have had some prior education, but it was probably nothing more than basic literacy. So talk about someone who basically started school probably about the age of 14. It became clear that he was very gifted academically, and with the support of his local teachers, he gained the attention of a local nobleman, Count Karel Starší z Žerotína. Maybe we won't all say that together. Anyway, Count Žerotín, he was from a long-established aristocratic family who had immense wealth and power. Now, just to give you an idea of how much wealth they had, in 1989, after the fall of communism in Czechoslovakia, they restored certain lands to families who had land seized by the communists in 1948, and the Žerotín family received land, even in 1989. So you're talking how much they must have had way back then. And basically, Žerotín took him under his arms, under his wings, so to speak, and he funded his education. So partly this was a charitable endeavour, but also Žerotín was, again, devout Brethren, and he had an idea that what he wanted to see were well-educated Christian leaders and thinkers in his religious community. So there was a number of these people from, well, all boys actually, from very, very poor backgrounds that he basically sponsored through the Reformed Gymnasium of Herborn. He then went and sent him to Heidelberg, paid for all his fees. And later in his life, when Kamensky was in exile, he protected him, though by that point, Kamensky basically had to hide in a tree. So you can argue, how luxurious was that protection? In 1614, after having been in Heidelberg and so on, Kamensky returns to Prešov as a teacher, and he was ordained as a minister in the Moravian Brethren. And he gradually became more and more significant in that denomination to the point that he was made a bishop. In 1617, it became clear, so this is just shortly after his ordination, that the new emperor would die with no direct heir. And basically, the Ferdinand II of Austria became Holy Roman Emperor, and he decided to rescind the previous religious agreement over the Kingdom of Bohemia. So, tensions again rose. Someone else was pushed out of a window in another defenestration of Prague in 1618. Basically a representative of the emperor, and war broke out. Now, It's likely that Fulnik, which was the little town where Kaminsky was the pastor, was basically ransacked and burnt to the ground. He was forced into exile, his library was destroyed, and he lived as a fugitive until 1628. So this was the time that various legends emerge about Count Gerotin hiding him in old oak trees and things in order to protect him. The Brethren Church was completely banned, and Kamensky carried on leading basically an underground church as a bishop from either just over the border with Poland or from, was it an oak tree? Is it really a tent? Is it really the hovel? I kind of like the idea of a bishop stuck in an old oak tree. This kind of tickles my sense of humour. Now I work in a bishop's office. But you never know. And as he was finally forced completely out of that sphere, he started travelling widely through Europe. And amazingly, his career as an educational theorist took off. So we're going to look at two basic planks of his educational theory with a theological twist. Then we're going to look at some of his spirituality. Okay? Because I realise that a lot of this is stuff that is just so foreign to everyone that is going to need a whole lot of background. So this is his picture book. This is the first page. Anyone that speaks German or Latin might have a better shot at understanding. Note the first language is Czech. We talked about his whole priority of language, of the vernacular education. The first language is Czech. He has only translated it into Latin and German in order to help people who could already learn Czech learn the others as well. This is really so different to what was the norm back then. So Kamensky believed in the absolute necessity of being educated in a mother tongue, and it really was a product of his theology. He believed that everyone should be able to read and understand the Bible in their native language. The Bible had to be available in their native language. They had to be able to read it. And this was his motivation for arguing for universal education and literacy. So no longer was education to be seen as the preserve of the elite, but instead it would be for all. So in 1649, in the Great Didactic, which was one of the Latin works that was widely published, he writes, "Not the children of the rich or the powerful only, but all alike, boys and girls, both noble and ignoble, rich and poor, in all cities and towns, village and hamlets, should be sent to school." That was really about 250 years before that argument was really put into practice and people actually really did see universal education, even in the UK. The point omitted by most educational theorists, though, when they actually look at him, is that actually the end of learning for Kamensky is a wholehearted devotion to Jesus Christ. So he doesn't just advocate literacy for literacy's sake. Literacy is a tool to which you can get to what he thinks is really important. So what's really interesting here is after this first page, which was his invitation to learn, you get your ABCs. And you get a delightful little pictures with numbers. As I said, do look at the book later. Some farmyard animals. I quite like this one. This is the punishment of criminals. So some people being hung and little descriptions so you can learn to read about that. But after you go through all of these, you get about 5 pages on the importance of receiving Jesus Christ as your personal saviour. That's the end of the book. So all of this style of education in Kamensky's mind is to be used for that one aim. It's not just education for education's sake or literacy for literacy's sake. It's not an argument he makes from economics that if you educate these children, they'll do better in life. But it's all because of his religious convictions. Another one of his ideas, if we just scroll back. Can anyone understand any of that, by the way, in German or Latin? Okay, so the introduction, it's the introduction is an invitation. This is the teacher, Utitel. "Come here, child, and I will teach you and learn how to be wise." The child says, "What does it mean to be wise?" The teacher, "Everything that is necessary to know well, to do well, to speak well." The child says, "Who will teach me all of that?" The teacher replies, "I will, with the help of God." There's an invitation to learn. Again, this is very culturally foreign for back then. The idea of you ask a child, do you want to learn? Come with me, have a look. Which goes back to the idea of those nature walks, doesn't it? The idea that we take a small child by the hand and we say, come and look at the frog. The child has to become a willing and essential participant whose thoughts and motivations in the educational process are vital. And the interesting point to draw on is that the response of the child to the invitation of the teacher isn't to accept, but is to question. Come and learn to be wise. What does that mean? And there's an entering into dialogue of the teacher and the child, who's supposed to be really quite little. In the same way that Kamensky also has as one of his theological, really totally non-negotiables, the need for personal inquiry about faith, which is what we'll get onto when we talk about what he writes in here, about the need for every person to view themselves as a pilgrim in the world who has to try and make inquiries and learn how it is to be wise. For Kamensky, unashamedly, in his spiritual writings, wisdom is not the wisdom of the world, but is the wisdom of God. He quotes extensively from Proverbs. And in fact, there's an amazing scene in this book where the pilgrim discovers the queen of the wisdom of the world. And he stands there talking to her, amazed by her wisdom. And then someone called Solomon comes up and tugs the queen's veil, and it crumbles away, and he sees this leprous face. So he's got his view of wisdom is that of an understanding of wisdom in the biblical and the theological sense. So what is it to be wise for him? For Kamensky, it's synonymous of what is it to know God? We go on. So with all this in mind, we turn to his spirituality, because as I said, you can read those passages, and if you don't know some of his theological convictions beforehand, there we are, you can just read them as a fairly, you know, democratic idea of education. He had a democratic idea of education, but it was driven by his theological convictions. So, can everyone read this? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to tell his first sort of pillar of his Christian spirituality is his absolute conviction of the personal need for conversion, and conversion as an experience. So, as I said, this book is a little bit Pilgrim's Progress, but better, is what I'm going to call it. So you've got a pilgrim walking around the world, trying things out, who gets himself deceived at various points, and at this point he, that's a pilgrim, receives Christ as his guest. I pondered these things within myself, awaited what was to follow, then behold, a bright light burst forth from above. Raising my eyes towards it, I saw the upper window full of brilliance, out of which a man came down to me. In form, indeed, he was similar to us people, but in his splendour he was truly God. Although his face shone greatly, yet it could be looked upon with human eyes. Nor did it inspire terror, but radiated a loveliness such as I have never seen anywhere in the world. Then he, the epitome of kindness and goodwill, addressed me in these most gracious words. And he carries on, Jesus talks to him for several pages. And goes there, hearing this speech and realizing that this was my Saviour, Jesus Christ, of whom I had heard some mention even in the world, I clasped my hands, not with fear and doubt as in the world, but with full joy and complete trust. Reaching out to him, I said, here I am, my Lord Jesus, take me to yourself. I wish to be yours and to remain yours forever. Speak to your servant and grant I may obey. Say what you wish and grant that I may find pleasure in it. Impose on me what you please and grant that I may bear it. Use me for whatever you desire and grant that I may be equal to the task. Command what you wish and grant what you command. May I be nothing, that you alone may be everything. And he carries on praying. I'm going to miss the rest of that and get to the end of this. While I was still speaking, a still greater light began to shine around me. Those pictures that I had first seen scratched and broken now appeared to be completely whole, clear and beautiful. They began to move before my eyes. The scattered and broken wheels were joined together to form a marvellous instrument similar to a clock that illustrated the course of the world and God's wonderful guidance. Ladders were repaired and set against the window that let in the light of heaven. Thus I perceived it was possible to look out. The thing about Kamensky is that in his writings, he's very autobiographical. So the details in The Labyrinth about the miller, he writes about how his travelling companions were shot down with arrows, referring to the way in which his wife and his children died of disease during the war. And so when you read this, this very much comes from the text with Kamensky's own voice, recounting his own story, but then arguing it as normative for anyone. Now, we can see how this is slightly problematic pastorally, maybe, to our ears, no matter how charismatic or Pentecostal we might take a view of conversion, because he talks in very, very dramatic terms and yet lays these out as absolutes. He has a very strong line. In fact, he has a whole chapter about telling the difference between the true Christians and the false Christians, to the point that he would argue that people who have not had this kind of conversion experience and this interpersonal exchange are not Christian at all. He talks about the invisible church and the very few true Christians. There's a whole chapter of that in there, which I don't have time to read to you, but I can do later if you like. And while we're at it, should we talk about his view on Luther? Remember, they have a separate strand of Reformation. So in 1660, he wrote this. Our forefathers sought to unite with all true Christians, especially the German churches renewed through Luther. Remember, the Czechs thought the Lutherans were late on the act. They were unable to achieve this end, however, because these Lutheran churches had not yet truly begun to ensure that Christ would receive his proper place, not only in the pulpit as a teacher or at the altar as a priest, but as on the throne as the king. He didn't even regard the Lutherans as true Christians because they didn't have a high enough view of Jesus as king. So we're talking about someone who has this very, very strong experiential idea of conversion and then this very, very high idea of the majesty of Christ. Ties into maybe the second one I'm going to highlight. These aren't an exclusive list. It appears that Kamensky would argue that the single greatest practical indicator that someone is truly a Christian, remember one of these elusive true Christians, is humility. So, we've got one here. What their priests and theologians are like, referring to the true Christians. I saw here a certain number of priests and preachers according to the needs of the church. All were dressed simply, and their manner was as gentle and kind among themselves as it was to others. In prayer, reading, and meditation, they spent more time with God than with people. What time they do have, they spend teaching others, together in a group or privately. Their preaching, as their hearers assured me, and as I myself experienced, was never heard without an inner moving of the heart. Going back to the conversion argument. And was for the power of divine eloquence flowed from their mouths. From those listening, I saw joy when the mercy of God was described and tears when human ingratitude was discussed. For the preaching was full of truth, life, and fervour. The preachers considered it shameful to teach anything of which they themselves were not an example. Desiring to converse with them, I approached one of them who was a man of venerable grey hair on whose countenance shone something divine. When he spoke to me, his speech was full of kindly severity. And it was clear in every way that he was God's ambassador, for he emitted absolutely no smell of the world. When I wished to address him by title, in keeping with our custom, he did not permit it, calling this the foolishness of the world. He said that for him it was sufficient title and honour that I address him as a servant of God, or, if I wished, as my father. When he gave me his blessing, I felt I know not what delight and what joy expanding in my heart. And he carries on to say, and I truly understood that genuine theology is something more powerful and more penetrating than what is generally experienced. Elsewhere, if you go outside of the Labyrinth of the World and into some of his lesser translated works, and I'm still working on the eternal translation of On Christian Perfection, Kamensky almost gets to the point of sort of worm theology. I don't know if you've heard that term before. The idea that we're completely unworthy, we're completely unlovable, we are completely nothing as human beings. But then this is strangely moderated by this overwhelming understanding of the all-encompassing love of Christ. So Kamensky argues that if to truly encounter the love of God is to truly understand how unworthy we are, both as we face God, but also as we face each other. So you have this very dramatic conversion experience that he's very important, this highly experiential idea of faith, and then this sort of humility is the crowning virtue. But it's humility in a face of the overwhelming love of God. If you are thinking this sounds faintly like the Pietists, basically his granddaughter married Zinzendorf. So you kind of go a couple of generations on from Kamensky and you start seeing the emergence of Pietism, but you can see its roots definitely here. And I think there is probably quite a strong argument, although because of the war and because of the nature of the underground church, these records weren't passed on, but probably there was teaching passed on that then later emerged, and his granddaughter marrying Zinzendorf is a pretty good indicator of that one. Next, the normality of persecution. Now, this book was written in 1631, so it was in the middle of his exile. It was following the war and the fact that his church, his whole, he was a bishop of a church which was outlawed, basically. So it's not that surprising that he is very concerned with persecution in his writings. It's an everyday experience for his church members. But he seems to see it as a need for the true Christians, remember true, capital T, Christians, capital C, to not only expect persecution, but also to rejoice in it. He appears at points to believe that all things, however good or bad, come from God, who is good. So even if we therefore experience them as bad, we should thank him because they are in fact good. That's basically the line of argument. So we've got one here. To suffer for Christ is a joy. I saw that it is easy not only to do what God desires, but also to suffer what God imposes. Notice, suffer what God imposes, an idea if it's bad, it still comes from God. For not a few of those here were slapped and spat upon by the world, yet they cried for joy and lifting their hands to heaven praised God that he had deemed them worthy to suffer for his name. So they not only believed in the crucified, but were also crucified themselves in his honour. Others who had not endured such things envied them with a holy envy, fearing God's wrath for their own lack of chastisement and separation from Christ for bearing no cross. Therefore they kissed the scourge and the rod of God whenever it was inflicted and embraced every kind of cross. This is an unpublished translation by me of one of Kamensky's other works. Says this, times nor alterations will never alter nor remove the true and full love of God from anyone. If the Lord God should give pleasing things, such a man, that's a devout man, would delight in them as a gift of God and praise the Lord. I have capitalised divine he's to iron the grammar. So big H's, God, little H's, is the Christian. If he should take them away again, that's God. He, the Christian, would say with Job, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May his name be praised. If he should suffer discipline, be it bitter, he would say with David, your rod, why did that always, autocorrects to road? Your rod and your staff, God, they comfort me. And then Kamensky adds, beat, punish and scourge me. That's not really in Psalm 24, is it? Only do not take love away. And uses actually the word that's more commonly used for grace there. For even if God begins to ferociously establish such discipline in him, that's the believer, in face of all that is in his heart is not roused, but he would say with Job, though the Lord may slay me, how could I not hope in him? If he were to be free again, he would say, I love the Lord, for he has freed my soul from death. In short, whatever the Lord God might do with them before all they place into his hands, love is expected from him, and love will transform him. It's this, one level you can see it as the product of someone who's lived through steep persecution, yet it seems to be pretty much on the level of the Christian masochist. this very, 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 it's almost a fatalistic view that says everything that happens is God. But I don't think he is a fatalist. I think he has this idea of God may permit something that will then shape the believer. And if you are a true Christian, remember how high the bar Kamenski sets for true Christians is. He believes it will be something that will be more glorious for the believer. Now, this is all kind of odd when you think of his idea of the universality of education. So every primary school child will become that kind of true Christian. Because that seems to be a very high bar of popular religion, doesn't it? So finally, one other one I'm going to bring out. And this one is where it gets a little bit weird. Mystical joy. So what Kamenski describes in The Labyrinth of the World or his other spiritual writings is fairly consistent with various parts of the mystical tradition. I mean, he talks of the espousal of the believer to Christ and of the fullness of his love, and he uses almost erotic terminology. We're going to look at this one in a second. So, does anyone here speak any Slavonic languages? Broadly, there's two groups of words for love. There's laska and there's milost. And he vacillates between the two and uses both, even the sort of more human love word, to refer to the idea of loving God. So it's a sort of a nuance you can't really bring out in translation, but he vacillates between the two in quite a dramatic way. So this again is from The Labyrinth of the World. You have seen in the married state how those who fall in love abandon all to belong to each other. Do likewise. Forsake everything, even your own self, and give yourself fully over to me. This is supposed to be Christ speaking to the pilgrim. Then you will be mine and all will be well. As long as you fail to do this, you will surely find no peace of mind, for in the world everything changes, all that your mind and desire pursues apart from me. All else will bring toil and discontent. Finally, all will forsake you, and the happiness you found in the world will turn to sadness. Therefore, my son, I advise you faithfully, leave everything and take hold of me. Be mine and I will be yours. Let us close ourselves together in this chamber and you will experience truer pleasure than can be found in earthly marriage. Seek to please me alone, to have me as a counsellor, guide, witness, comrade and companion in all things. And whenever you speak to me, say, I only and you, my Lord, for there is no need to concern ourselves with a third. Cling only to me, gaze only on me, converse sweetly with me, embrace me, kiss me, and in turn expect all these things from me. There's various other points in his writings where he seems to be almost caught up in what I'm going to call as an excursus in ecstasy. So suddenly, particularly in the case of the pilgrim, which is supposed to be a story, you suddenly find him sort of spending about a paragraph on what sounds like lost in wonder, love and praise before he finally comes back to the point. And a good example of this, the closing paragraphs of The Labyrinth of the World start as a string of quotations from Isaiah and Revelation about visions of Christ in heaven, but suddenly it begins to switch to an account from the writer. And so you suddenly start thinking, is this Kamenski or the pilgrim? Is Kamenski recounting a vision that he personally has experienced? Now, given the way in which his life and the pilgrimage become merged in the story, and given this is far from untypical of his other writings, so I think my reading of Kamenski is that actually he's writing about visions he says he's experienced himself. And that is a rather central part of his idea of this ongoing, highly experiential Christian encounter. And yet, unlike many people who write this way, his assumption is that his experience is normative. So the pilgrim is supposed to represent every single one of us walking in the world. So unlike someone like Teresa of Avila, who seems to be very, very aware that her revelations and her dreams are for her, they're to be shared, but that there's no assumption on her part that everyone will experience this. Maybe this is the Protestant twist on that, that Kamenski thinks that everyone ought to. So, if we go back full circle to his picture book, and we think about his ABCs and his animal noises and his farmyard lessons and his workshop illustrations and his dire warnings of the long arm of the law. This slightly alters our view of what he really thinks he's teaching those children, because these spiritual ideas are what he sees as the end of all knowledge. I was going to take a photo of that particular book page, but it is full of Middle Czech, and I wasn't sure how many people's German or Latin would really be up to it. I didn't want to translate it. I'm going to leave that there for now. I've managed to persuade you all that he was a hymn writer and a theologian, hopefully. But I'll take any questions. Thank you.